It's time for the Carol Cox Show right here at K108. If you have questions or comments for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080. And now, here's Carol.
Thank you. Okay, good morning. Welcome to the Carol Cox Show. A lovely day here, a little chilly and the wind. And it's absolutely a beautiful day, though, here in Hawaii. And got a lot of things to talk about. If you want to join in, any topic you want to toss out there, I do apologize. I had a couple people see me on the street and ask that could they call in. They had a couple things they'd want to talk about, so I invited them. Whether they call or not, I don't know. That's up to them. But if you have something you want to talk about, feel free to call 888-5204, 888-5204. There's a number of things that I'll be chatting about if I get the chance, if we don't get waylaid with the interest that you folk want to talk about. And as you know, environmental things and all of that. And recently, someone called me. Apparently, they reside in the Alawai area or frequent the area near the golf course and the dog park and back of Iolani School. They were complaining that there's the State Department of Land and Natural Resources apparently went in and cut trees back because the trees were providing some shelter or a place where the homeless, members of the homeless population was living there, staying there, frequenting. So the resident called and said, or the citizen called and said that, ask if we could look at it and look into it. So if you want to get an idea of what it's like, apparently it's right by the dog park and it's right there in the Alawai where the channel dumps into the Alawai and then makes its way to the ocean and throughout the Alawai Canal. And so it's kind of give you an idea of why the Alawai tend to have so much trash and vegetation and floating down logs and trees and whatever. And of course, there's a natural sloughing that takes place upstream and find its way in the stream, falling off or breaking off or self-pruning or just old age or erosion, what have you. And then there you have that share of introduced volumes that come from a variety of people either doing landscaping or cutting back trees and just see the stream as being a dump. And to their demise, it might add to the surprise as well when we do get some heavy rain. With the low maintenance that we see, witness here with the streams, you might find yourself in high water, hell in high water, because if that water can't go anywhere, it's going to overflow its banks if it can't be channeled fast enough. So we went down and looked at the Alawai, and in looking, we did confirm that someone, either the Department of Land and Natural Resources or the Parks Recreation Division, were actually active and have been, and the complaint was that they just dumped it in the water, cut it, let it fall in the water, and just left it there. So you can see the remnants of some of the shelters that were used to house some of the people, the makeshift shelters. And it's unsightly, number one. Number two, it with the size of these trees and what have you, as they wash off into the Alawai and float down, they become a problem for navigation, snagging, and the buildup. So we hope to get that taken care of. And we'll see what happens. So if you want to, you can go to carolcox.com and see some of the pictures that we posted up. And again, 888-5204 is the number if you want to call in and chat with us. Sorry about that. We had a bird to fly in the little window there, just see if he's okay. But anyway, sorry about that. So another thing is out in Campbell Industrial Park. And what this is all speaking to is the sad state of affairs that we have invested in our, the amount of money and that we have invested in our natural resources. Supposedly, we have monies allocated by the state legislators, and you think that things would be just grand, but as I hate to sound like the broken record or the negative guy standing on the street corner, but this is just that. The Department of Land and Natural Resources, the State Health Department, and other agencies tasked with responding or protecting the natural resources is doing a really piss poor job. Whether it's agriculture, whether it's anything in the state now, these programs, the state-sanctioned programs, suffer, or the legislators actually fund these programs, they suffer from the intervention by non-profit organizations with special interests. And about 2-3 years ago, I brought to the attention out in Campbell Industrial Park, and you know that with the construction and building and always open land being taken and used for construction, and we need housing and what have you. So the Campbell Industrial Park, James Campbell Industrial Park, or some say Kalailoa, there is this one remnant of a overflow or a salt water overflow, brackish water, and you to appreciate it, you'd have to understand it would be as if someone took the downtown Honolulu and dug a small ditch about the size of 1.5 block long and put a little vegetation around it, and it's influenced by the ocean occasionally, so the water is salty and brackish from the fresh water flowing as well in the runoff. And you got this massive amount of construction debris and construction equipment and recycling and trash, and the area is situated on an already contaminated site from way back, from contaminated with magnesium. But you have this one little jewel of a ditch, and in that ditch you're likely to find on any given day or time in the cement jungle 5 of the state's native shorebirds or birds or water birds, we'll call them to keep it simple. You have the sanderling, this beautiful little white bird that forages, and some of you may refer to him as the palava bird. You have that sanderling, very delicate, black beak, whitish in color with the very little tiny black feet, and who runs along the shoreline pecking and picking up. And when you're looking at it, you wonder, this is the last thread of what once was this beautiful place of wetlands and what have you. And so you then have the tattler, the wandering tattler, or the ulili. And if you frequent the beach or go to the ocean shorelines, you'll occasionally see one sounding the alarm, if you're familiar with that. That's the tattler. Then you have the endangered stilt that is there, the Hawaiian stilt, blackbird with long pink legs, absolutely beautiful and striking bird. Then you have the plover, the least plover or the Pacific golden plover, however you, so, and it, these are common names we're using, so we'll, and then you have the ruddy turnstone. So those five birds are found in this little ditch at any given time. And then sometimes there's a vagrant or bird that have flown off course, maybe a Glaucus gull or a heron gull or some other water bird that have migrated off course to this area, and they find themselves out there in this little tiny spot. Well, my complaint was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, to the state. Someone had taken humongous pipe and laid them along the edge of this little ditch. Now, there's not much left. And the complaint was we wanted them to clean this up because it might present a problem or find their way into this little stream and providing a habitat for mongoose or what have you, or rats, that would make it easier for the birds to be preyed upon or interfered with. They don't nest in this area. They just use this area to forage and rest and just for the day of feed for crustaceans and what have you. Now, I had an occasion to ask the state health department what was the status of that. They then tell me, well, can you resend the pictures? What was that about again? So it's very painful to know that, you know, it's not that I'm going to a public person or a private person and saying, hey, we have this problem. You know, there's endangered species. It's your purview. It's your concerns. It's mandated that you protect these species. It's your job. All of that. And then you get this, what was it about again? Or where is this again? And I don't know about you, but how do you respond or react to that? These are professionals. You have to ask yourself, do they think that things are just too small or to pay attention to? Or do they think it's vital enough or of concern that, well, it's just a few birds? But when you, if you go there right now, if I took you there, you'd see five birds maybe of the Hawaiian stilt. And you don't know if that's the same five birds or just up the road is the Chevron refinery that has ponds and pools out there that these birds are attracted to as well. But there's a threat to them, could possibly have oil sheen or contamination or what have you. And some of them actually nest or forage in that area, but they use this area. So if you want to get an idea, if you're interested, go to carolcox.com, and we've posted some of the pictures up, and you'll see in a world now where there is very little left, and there's always a grab for more land, and in the past years, I've witnessed there as you driving down the road going into Campbell Industrial Park on the left there, that used to be a swale area where native birds and stilt and other birds have congregated, because there, after rains, there would be a collection of water that goes on for months, and it serves as wetlands and habitat. Well, they've allowed them to build that up, and so much for protecting wetlands and what have you. So I'm talking about this. It's not that sexy to many of you, probably. What's the big deal? This is indicative of what's to come. I believe that based on how things are operated now with special interests, special interests from nonprofits, people who have their own agenda. They're not looking at the bigger picture of collectively how the resources relate to one another and how protective we should be of these little spots. I mean, this is the last stand. And this is the last stand. So why should we just let it go or ignore it or without taking some action? You see. So it's rather painful and difficult to watch it play out, because we know we're losing habitat. We know we're losing species. And there should be a call to order in a more aggressive, more concerned. But I think what I'm witnessing, and I'm focusing on this little area to convey what is happening with the bigger picture. If it's found in boundaries, if it's a refuge, then the work concentrates on the refuge, within the boundaries of the refuge. Anything outside the refuge tend to have to struggle and hang on. But this little area that I'm talking about in Campbell Industrial Park is critical, because it provides forage and food and the rest for some of the species. So we can't afford to lose any more wetlands. We really can't, if we intend to be concerned with the health and welfare of our seabirds or our shorebirds, or even the replenishment of our aquatic resources, nearshore fisheries or anything, because all of these little things, the copepods and all of the worms and other critters that grow in that pond, find their way to the ocean or become part of the ecosystem or are part of the ecosystem. So when the state health department receives a complaint and then they do nothing about it, that doesn't set well. It just does not speak well of the program that they are funded to be. So if you are just a refuge, then you just operate within the parameters of that, and you focus on that, and you build banners, and you tell people you're protecting. But anything outside of that, and I understand that when there's private lands involved, but in this particular case, this is right at the shoreline, high water mark of the ocean. And it's like total chaos. You got this extreme operation of big machinery and fencing and gravel and piles of dirt and contaminated soils and just dumped and laying there, just airing out. And then you have this little fragile postage stamp of a refuge, of a sanctuary. And the state just allow anything and everything to just either run off into there, dump into it, paper blow from recyclers, dirt from construction people, and just the whole thing is kind of chaotic. So why then would the state not be willing to take on this area? And this is the Department of Health. If they couldn't have done anything with this area, why wouldn't they have called the state health, the State Department of Land and Natural Resources? So, again, I apologize for sounding way off course or talking about something that you really may not be interested in, but for those of you that are wanting to know about our, quote, wildlife management programs, if you're outside of the NARS, or if you're outside of the kind of point, or you're just on your own, the state affords you no protection. Now, yes, they will cite you if you are caught or reported and caught red-handed. But for businesses, and some of these pipes, you would need a tractor, trailer, truck to get just one of these pipes in place to dump it. So it's not something simple. We got to change our mindsets. We really do. And this is prevalent, this mindset that we see, whether it's wildlife, habitat management, agriculture, it's the same mindset. If it's money and it has sex appeal to it, and it's going to get them to look good, and they can polish up a little video and put up a brochure or go and record a sound and put it in their elevator to make it sound like, but that's where it's appear to stop the management of our natural resources within these agencies. Tend to stop after you leave their office, or you see them going through the grind. You see them, the people working, and you see them, but at the end of the day, if you can't pick up trash out of an area that is critical to the habitat or to these species, whether now maybe they may argue, well, it's not 100, but every at this day and age, every little bit counts. Because naturally and ecologically, over the years, the beaches were available to the birds foraging. But today, there's just not much beach left, so to speak. And people, when I say left, free of people. So these birds, we as human beings walk along and we compact the sand and the sea fleas, the crustaceans that the birds would normally eat. We've polluted. We've run off from streets and what have you, and lawns and what have you, have reduced that population. And so it's critical that you manage these little areas now, and instead of ignoring them, we need to try and expand them and enhance them. So that's probably don't make much sense to you now, but in the long run, if you take a gander at the conditions of the wildlife, you know, and if it's shearwater season, for example, I noticed that they were saying, well, you know, we need to work our lights. And for years, I mean, we should have been doing something about the lights along the streets long, long, long time ago. But the concerns were, well, let's not do anything because it would cost too much money. And people won't accept it and won't go for it. And that's a very interesting lame excuse, because they don't know what the people want because they never asked the people. But if it's something they want, they'll shove it down your throat, and it's a project that, you know, get it done. So I'm hoping that out at Campbell Industrial Park, some attention or appreciation is shown for that, and some work be done, and we're going to try and ask the state or whoever is responsible for that jurisdiction to do something. And if you go out there and you're interested in seeing it, go to it's situated back of the H power plant, and you go in the back and go out to the beach side and try and ignore the piles of contaminated soil and dirt. So you just keep in mind that you're going to see the birds this time. Because as you keep moving down, you'll see the large black piles of coal there at the AES plant, and you'll see the dust from the coal ash that have blown over the roads and what have you. So hopefully something happened. And if you want to just get a better view of it, go to carolcox.com and look there. And if you are a birder and you're looking to go out and do some birding and got relatives during the holidays, just take a hike out there. It's real close, and you can park and walk maybe 100 yards, and you can see it. Rather beautiful place anyway, with the tide pools adjacent to this area. So anyway, we have a problem with management of the natural resources, and this problem is not going to stop because the demand for land and the mindset and how the state agencies manage, they manage on the crises, or they manage under the mobility has gotten a gain from special interests of other nonprofits, nothing to do with government work, but they have their special projects, whether it's sustainable fisheries programs that they want to implement. One that is Suzanne Case is up to her neck in and trying to get that implemented and what have you. And it's all, it's really detracts from the real needs, the management concerns that we really have. But when you're nurturing your own little private programs and projects, these little sites like the postage stamp sites or the habitat like that in Campbell Industrial Park does not receive the attention, because money is being channeled or funneled away from that kind of activity. The special interest of protecting or getting out and trapping the mongoose in these specific areas, or making sure that it's not overgrown with the kiabi or the thorn trees and what have you of that sense. So it's not the whole world, but it's a part of it. And when you stand back and understand the critical nature of this, how sensitive it is. We're talking about water, birds that are in need of aquatic environments that require standing water, ponding, and what have you. And if we don't have that, we lose these species. And when we lose them, what are we selling the tourists? We're talking about this beautiful place called Hawaii. What is this beautiful place? Just Diamond Head, so you can hike up Diamond Head? Or is it all of the flora and the fauna that we are hoping to protect, and that's what we're really, as a package, selling? There's a stilt, a Hawaiian stilt, which is unique to the species on the mainland, the black-necked stilt, or the stilt there found there, or the plover, or, you know, is that Hawaii? The sanderling migrates, but again, found here in these islands. Is that Hawaii? Do we need to protect that, or are we just comfortable with hula dress and kukui nut lays and fake flowers? And is that where we're going? Is that the Hawaii we want to preserve and present and present to the rest of the world and ask them to come here? Or is it all the things that should be included that make up the fabric of this place called Hawaii? I mean, my friend told me I'm nuts for not grasping the real concerns. It says, if you look to see what they're doing to the native people, and you're trying to get an audience about birds, you know, and I'm not going to cave into that kind of thinking, but it does grab my attention a little bit and say, well, maybe you're right, you know. So I would like to see some of the old lands restored, personally. Not just for agriculture, but personally having some of these wetlands along the coast restored wherever possible. And they serve as like the lungs of the liver or of the environment. It provides habitat, it provides cleanliness, it cleans the water, it introduces a brackish element, that a habitat that allows these fish and the eggs and what have you to be attracted and lay eggs, and that contributes to a healthy environment. So, again, the cold shoulder that we see demonstrated here, or the behavior where the state can, I don't know where they get it, the gumption from, to simply discriminate or as to what is important. If I don't know what drives them, I honestly don't. I try to think of it and ask, what's the difference between you're saving habitat? You don't look at the numbers. If you save the habitat, you're likely to have a better production of the species. And if you manage it, managing that habitat and enhancing it, rather than having it shrunk by abuse and dumping and illegal dumping and overgrowth and what have you. That's what we need in this new age of thinking for natural resources in Hawaiiana and all of that. If we don't get it, we're going to see a great many of our species in the next 10, 15 years just gone completely. You might be able to see, for example, try to illustrate to you what on this island, the state of our natural habitat for seabirds. And you can give me a call and we'll talk about it, and I can show you if you like. Caller, thank you. Go ahead with your comments, question.
Yeah, I just caught the tail end of what you were saying there. I think part of when you talk about saving species and saving the habitats of species, or species just in general, part of that is looking at the world around you. You want to call it the environment or your ecosystem or whatever. You have to see it as an endemic part, not so much an extension. Part of it is seeing it as an extension of humans, as individuals, not seeing it as something other than. Mm-hmm. I think. Go ahead. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. I'm listening.
Oh. I think that we are kind of, as individuals, we're stuck in this kind of, I would call it the Francis Bacon approach, referring to the writer is the writer Francis Bacon. Polymath, I would say, Francis Bacon, whose idea was to take nature and put it on the rack. You know, it's just sort of the idea of the bifurcation of human beings versus environment, individual against nature. Mm-hmm. If you see it as that aspect, then the environment and what's around you means nothing or very little. But if you see the environment and your ecosystem and what is around you as a extension of you or part of what makes you exist and what allows you to survive as a person, mm-hmm. then you won't befoul it. You won't end up killing other animals and other species to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
It's your mindset. You know, I mean, it's how we see what in the ecosystem around us. And we may not use the term ecosystem. We may say environment, but it's also an ecosystem.
Yeah. Well, what happens is, in this vein, state agencies and federal agencies is an extension of people's caring, because we're taxed, and those tax dollars are set aside and earmarked for the specific use in protection and enhancing and preserving and using wisely the natural resources. So when the state fails and the state is it's commandeered, its program is focused on things, as I've said earlier, about just certain pet projects, and then other things go by the wayside. There's a difference between asking an individual to respect the resources and the natural resources than to have a state agency or federal agency to carry out its fiduciary responsibilities that where monies have been allocated to use wisely and be specific and use them to enhance and better the environment and protect it. There's two different subjects going on.
But again, I think you know, bring up the agency aspect, and that's an issue of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
If you have agencies that are responsible for dealing with the ecosystem and the environment, and they're failing in their responsibility, then that's a whole different matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, jokingly, I used to say this, and I've witnessed this a lot. Here you've got an agency that's responsible for managing donuts and making sure that everybody has in the village has a donut. And then here comes some guy with an idea for nonprofit, and he says, let's make Twizzles, you know. And, well, how do we do that? Oh, I'll show you. Here you. What I need to do is take half of your budget and half of your equipment and then dedicate that equipment to this new idea of the Twizzles. And so, oh, okay. And then you then go and you say to the legislators, I know that you gave this money for donuts, but on the other hand, we got this new idea for Twizzles, and this guy, Carol Cox, is a Twizzle king, and he's going to make wonders and what have you. And so we then get permission to use monies that were allocated from the legislators to go into the Twizzles, and the rest of the village, or half the village, don't get donuts anymore. So I hate to be that mundane in my illustration, but it's that simple. It's taking the bread out of our mouth now of the environment. It's taking food for thought. It's taking the resources that we have that are scarce anyway, right?
Right.
And we then embrace new ideas that has little or nothing to do with the actual everyday management. Let's take care of the basic elemental concerns, right? Those basic things to make sure that where there is existing habitat, we stand our grounds and we enhance that rather than coming on with some newfangled idea of what have you. But
that sounds good, Mr. Twizzle King.
Yeah. Well, exactly, and that's there's a lot of Twizzle Kings here in the state of Hawaii. Lots of them.
That's gonna be staying in my mind for a while.
No, I mean because it's kind of.
I don't even know what a twizzle is, but you know.
Well, just I use the term twizzle because you can use your own imagination. It ain't a donut.
Okay.
So, you know, and the bottom line is that the point that I'm trying to stress is that we get distracted by new ideas that don't fit into the old ways, and they conflict, and they rob the existing, what really works, the natural presence of a wetlands. We don't need to modify that. We just need to enhance it to make sure and preserve it. Because it was here when we got here. And it is unique in that it provides these species that are, some have straight bills, some have curved bills, some have long pink legs, and others have short little, you know, stubby legs. And, and some can has a stout neck that flips over rocks, and that's why you call them the ruddy turnstone, you know. But if you take away all of that, that opportunity to flip rocks at the habitat where the one can't wade in water, so he won't need pink legs, he won't need tall legs. All of that is as simple as it seems. It's fragile. And there's no room for twizzle-dee and twiddle-dums, right? It's just
right.
When the governor appoints chairman of the Land and Natural Resources, the Land and Natural Resources should be focusing on enhancing and preserving, right? And using wisely the natural resources, not
should
coming
be,
in.
that's more of what the ideal is as opposed to the reality.
But see, and if we had the time and the luxury, but these are fragile things we're speaking about. Very fragile things that have evolved over eons, and we're right there staring it in the face. It's the difference. See, it's not
right.
A human factor or a human decision. These are things where we're going to undo the uniqueness and to preserve the uniqueness. Everything is evolving eventually anyway, but we shouldn't accelerate the evolution because
right.
We find ourselves with freaks like you and me. You know, because we were on a fast track of evolving, right?
You shouldn't dilute the evolution.
Yeah, we, you know.
Because if you damage it, you're diluting it.
Yeah, and so when you take away all those things that contribute to the well-being of these species, then you've offset. But hey, you got your twizzle factory, you know, and that's a new thing. At one time, it was biodiversity. Next time it was hot spots. You remember those terms that we...
Yeah, well, that's right. Biodiversity.
Right.
Hot spot. Well, now hot spot is where you go for Wi-Fi.
Yeah. So,
words,
you know...
Words get co-opted for other things.
Yeah. And so that's the problem with most of this. And you take, for example, before you call, I started to say, you go up to Waianae. Along the coast there. Now, there were some very valuable wetlands in that area and runoff running from the mountains and collecting, and it provided habitat for these species. Now, there is a cemented ditch that sometimes, if you go there at the right time, it houses some 400 or so ruddy turnstones all collecting to go to migrate. But no one knows that. It's just a funky cement wall now, a cement ditch. And then there you got basil farms and people dumping this trash and offal and what have you. And then you have in the stream itself, you have stilt, the endangered species. But it's all cemented. It once was a wetland. And then if we go to Waipahu, you go to the sanctuary there. Around it, there's an illegal dump where they're piling high and high and just mounds of illegal trash and sofas and what have you. So you don't get that kind of action. And then the refuge itself is built on an old landfill dump from the incinerator right there in Waipahu. So you understand... It is so critical that what we have left, we need to manage it with intensity and be not distracted by someone that's coming with a new fangled fad, a new style, or twizzle sticks or something.
Yeah. No twizzle dums and no twizzle dees.
Yeah, so that is just something that is it's tearing away at the last remnants of any sensible management. And there's only certain lands, and if you notice, much of the lands that these new people come with these new ideas, it's state lands or federal lands, because there's just as much more private land. No one's going to dedicate their private land to these issues because they were going to make a profit and they got to pay for the taxes on it or whatever, right?
Right.
So the eyes are set on public resources. All of these newfangled ideas and whatever it is, even down to the the farming, and we will talk about farming in the next hour, but all of that, a lot of it is state lands. And let them come and buy their own land, and if they really want to go in there, but why are they eyeing state lands? Then they get a tax write-off and all of that, right? So how do we replenish our coffers, or how do we protect our resources if we lend it all to the guys with the new ideas that really won't complement what the old ways are, or the, as we emerging from the old era? But anyway, we'll be back, and I don't know if you saw the today's paper on the inside of the Star Advertiser, as much as I hate talking about someone else's news. There's a Maureen O'Connell wrote an article, and basically farming our land. So we'll be back shortly here. If you want to call back, do so.
All right? Maybe I will.
Okay, aloha.
All right.
On KWAI. It's time for the Carol Cox Show right here at K108. If you have questions or comments for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080. And now, here's Carol.
Welcome back to the Carol Cox Show. That was Miss Mahalia Jackson, and I played that for a specific reason. I have a friend who's houseless down there on the beach, and he asked me if I would play that because it's Thanksgiving and all of those good things, but just the fact that if that's all the man asks and it makes him feel good, there you go. And I love Mahalia Jackson myself. Brought up and raised on gospel. I don't know if you guys ever really gone to a gospel gathering, but once you get started, there ain't no stopping until they pull the plug and the last note on the guitar is playing, you know. Whether it's the Heavenly Bound Singers, and these are the old days of the Southern Baptist upbringing that you're one's exposed to. In those days from Mississippi and whatever. So I just thought I'd play that and be happy. So I hope you were listening and enjoyed it. Alrighty. So we were talking about state and federal and the fiduciary responsibilities and owning up and carrying out the wishes of the state legislature that's mandated and what have you. But somehow things get, I guess I don't want to sound naive and suggest that I'm just completely in the dark, operating in the dark, but this today's insight section of Star Advertiser and Maureen O'Connell stepping up local food production in our island state is a sensible goal. I agree with that. I mean, okay, that's just basic common sense. And we should work together. With greater access to fresh, homegrown products, Hawaii could reap economic, environmental, and health gains. And that's true. But what are they? What are the... what about the lobby that the importers of... For every onion, every cantaloupe, everything that comes in, there's a company that makes a nickel or dime on it. So why would we be encouraged to... would they be encouraged to loosen their grasp of these products and find it cheaper to for them? They don't have to farm it. They don't have to... some of the big importers, they don't have to do anything. So where... where would that give? Do you think the lobby is there? Are we being honest with ourselves to say that, you know, there's all this talk about and new kid on the block comes in and, yeah, we can sustainability and we can farm more and what have you. And I often wonder, did he come in last night or was he born last night? Because there is a lobby here and there's a control, the importers of the food items. They're not going to just say, well, yeah, we want more of our food produced here and give up their line or their control of the import product. How are you going to get past that? How are you going to overcome that? And how are you going to overcome the political control that they have, that the Department of Agriculture has, the people that run the Department of Agriculture, the people that have inserted themselves in the Department of Agriculture, all of that, the state Hawaii Department of Agriculture, who? You see. And over these years, the aggressive beat back of... And I do know that at one time, you know, when we have a concern with fruit flies here, for example, getting and being transmitted through shipments of products out of state. I accept that. That's a reality. But I don't believe that it's been treated with the kind of importance or assign a degree of importance that it should have been in finding ways to grow these products. And so now the conversation lends itself to, well, sustainable for local consumption. Well, then you're back to square one because the importers of all these major food producers or importers, you know, they're bringing it in. They have a lobby. They have a control. They're not giving up much. So no one wishes to speak to that. I rarely see any even mention of that aspect of it, or that side of it, let's say. No one wants to touch that. They don't want to talk about it. There's that entity or group of people or that layer of people that has full control and then have the tentacles inside of agriculture department. So a lot of this pipe dream stuff or this theory that things are going to work out if we had the land, right, and you're going to grow all the products that you need locally and sustain itself. There are people that raise tomatoes and throw away containers full of tomatoes to control the market price. Some of the stores won't even accept some of the volumes of them. So there's going to be... it's not a simple rewrite and a simple reassignment of that. And we just celebrated, the governor celebrated Core Ridge, you know, the groundbreaking. And that was considered really important ag land. So there's this, I hear people talk about farming and what have you and this and that, and it's like, well, you're not being realistic, and you're damn sure not willing to challenge the system. And so you're talking out the side of your mouth. On one hand, you're dreaming of this, but on the other hand, you're not willing to fight, and you wouldn't even know where to start to fight because it is so politically controlled that, I mean, if I was in a position where every onion came into the state, I got 5 cents on it. That's a heck of a deal. I'm not representing that that is the exact price or whatever, but you get the gist of it, the example. So until we remove those impediments or those obstructions or those concerns, you're going to be singing a chorus like you've never sang before, and it'll be like a broken record over and over and over. And people come with half the solution, but the solution to our food concerns here in our productivity of food has all to do with how willing are you to stick your neck out and challenge the political system and initiate that conversation or that dialogue and openly discuss it. How many are out there willing to do that? Even with the ADC, the Agriculture Development Corporation, as great of its promises, if you go back and look at how political it is, who's involved, and Donovan De La Cruz and all those people, it's the making of a kingdom. And you ain't got a chance. Farmers, independent farmers are struggling and begging for land and what have you. And there's thousands of acres potentially sitting there available in state hands now, and they're not moving and fast enough. But they'll entertain any private entity that comes along with the twizzle idea. Caller, thank you for calling. How can we help you? Go ahead.
Hi, my name's Tom, and I'm calling regarding Bike Share Hawaii.
Okay, that's my favorite subject, Tom. You there?
Okay, I'm sorry?
That's my favorite subject. Let's talk about that.
Okay.
So, you're Tom Kopp, right? And,
yes.
And you shared with me earlier in conversations a while back that you filed a complaint because you had concerns with the city registering Michael Formby and... Ray Soon and others and COPA, all these politically influenced people or influential people who founded and registered Bike Share Hawaii.
That is correct. I filed a verbal complaint with, I believe it was Chuck Total, who was the executive director for the Ethics Commission at the time.
Mm-hmm. And when was this now? About a year, 2 years ago?
It was when Bike Share first incorporated, and my son had alerted me to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went down to the DCCA to look at the articles of incorporation, and I was alarmed to find out that these public officials had used the city's address as their mailing and business address.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that was inappropriate at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's funny. I just in the last 9 months or so, I filed a complaint because I stumbled across this fact that they had registered this business and using a city office and all. And I filed an ethics complaint, and they said that was not a problem. And now what was surprising when you shared your story, it's like, well, they'd already looked at this, but they pretended not to know anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, kind of strange.
One correction is, I think there might have been an ordinance that allowed them to to do that, but I'm not clear on that. The problem that I have with Bikeshare Hawaii right now and with the city is that they might be violating the pedaling ordinance.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I take my First Amendment right to pedal on the sidewalks of Waikiki Beach.
Mm-hmm.
Bikeshare Hawaii is not paying the city anything for their bike stations, which I think is illegal and might be a theft of using the city property.
Mm-hmm. Well, others
allegedly.
Others have raised the same allegation. But the problem is, the city, I filed a request for information now about a year now, and I've gotten not a single direct response from the city.
Wow. That's surprising. I've also had the same problems where I filed a request for disclosure under the public records law, and they've tacked on exorbitant fees for research and copying fees and what have
mm-hmm,
you.
Mm-hmm. Well, with the Bikeshare Hawaii, the original amount of money that was necessary was gotten from the state health department, the tobacco fund or whatever, that the health fund, and that money was then given to the city to serve the city serve as a pass through. Contrary to what was being represented in the past, was that it was a non-profit putting the money up. It was a state health department where the money got, and the state health department had a contract for services, and the city was going to serve as a pass-through for that, and that was the contract. And they were supposed to have 200 bike sites, but they only had 100 so far, and then they've increased it, I guess, after we raised the issue. But I was asking, well, are they in compliance with the contract? Are they all the conditions of the contract? What's the status? And I've gotten some stalling on the part of the state health department as well. So the transparency is lacking.
One of the things that they're operating on supposedly on a street usage permit.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you can use the street because there's a ban on peddling. It's a total-wide ban in the islands, and there's few exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think Bikeshare Hawaii falls under that category because they're doing a retail business, doing bike rentals on public lands,
mm-hmm.
and therefore it should have been put out to public bid.
Mm-hmm.
And but you know, that's like you said, you know, they're doing whatever they want to do.
They seem to have a common theme. All of them have a common thread here. One, it's public resources that's being taken and gotten in partnership with a private entity.
Right.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, Ulupono was involved in this Bikeshare. I saw that they were in the advertisements on the webpage that they had some participation in it. But again, is that true?
From my understanding, I think Ulupono had initially put seed money into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I did some research and found that at one time, Bikeshare Hawaii had their offices in Ulupono's suites up in the First Hawaiian Bank building.
Mm.
And I was amazed with that connection.
I see. Hold on one second. You there, caller?
Yeah. Hi.
I don't know why we got this beeper.
I don't know what's going on, but...
Are you near your phone or your computer or anything? Radio?
No. TV.
Okay, well, hang up and let me chat with this gentleman, then you can call right back. I don't know why we have this problem. Okay, thank you. Okay, go ahead, Tom.
Okay. Right. Yeah, I had visited their suite, and I was amazed at the, you know, that Bike Share Hawaii's location at one time was at Ulupono's offices. And I think Ulupono at one time at the beginning had given some seed money to Bike Share Hawaii.
Okay. So with the $1 million that the state health department put out, and it's not clear if the state, if the city was going to give $1 million. Somewhere they say they were and they weren't, but then they're taking probably more than $1 million because they're giving away city streets, city sidewalks, city parking meters, and revenue from that. And then some of the state properties, I don't know if they're all state properties or the sidewalk belonged to the city, but where these things have been popped up in place, what does that do for, is it discriminating against, does it raise concerns with discrimination concerns that here you, certain people can sell things along the sidewalk and others can't or provide a service?
I think it becomes a First Amendment issue. Years ago, the Hare Krishnas had set up tables on the sidewalks in Waikiki, particularly near Kailani and Kalakaua Avenues, and they were selling T-shirts with religious messages or spiritual messages. And then the city had enacted the peddling ordinance and put a ban, and it went up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, where the Ninth Circuit Court had upheld the ban. Hawaii is one of the, or Honolulu is one of the few cities in the United States has a total ban on peddling. And right now with Bike Share Hawaii operating on the public streets and sidewalks, I feel that there are First Amendment issues with the city violating. Because I, in particular, have a nonprofit, and I've been trying to get my organization to operate on the beach. And, you know, the city has, ignored or denied my requests.
I see. So you're saying that, in your opinion, the operation of that bike share program is actual peddling, or consistent with the definition of peddling? Selling a service?
Is,
yeah, I see. I hadn't given any thought to that. That sounds interesting, because if there's a prohibition against, I mean, we know they can't sit, lie, and spit, but, and I had forgotten about the rule that where you could not be selling anything on sidewalks.
Yeah, the ordinance defines peddling as the means of sale or offer for sale, the renting or offer to rent or display for sale or rent of any goods, wares, merchandise, foodstuff, or other kinds of property or services.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, definitely I feel that the city and Bike Share are violating the peddling ordinance.
So,
I said earlier, that this should have gone out to public bid, and but this might enhance my argument in the future of the city violating my First Amendment rights to access Kuyu Beach Park.
So you think, would you say that the food trucks, were they banned too at one time unless they get certain permits? They don't sell?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, all peddling, you know, even like the lace sellers, back in the days, the lace sellers used to be on Kalakaua Avenue, and because of the peddling ban, they could no longer, operate, selling lace to the tourists and what have you.
Well, I'm going to ask my city council for kind of an interpretation. I'll ask him to see if that is, maybe that's some conflict there.
I think it definitely is. If you look at the Ninth Circuit Court of a decision. One of the reasons they put down, supported the ban was because the city had argued that it was for the health and safety of pedestrian traffic in the sidewalks of Waikiki. And yet, at the very place where the Hare Krishnas had their tables is almost the exact spot where BikeShare has their bike stations on the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, it also impedes people with wheelchairs and what have you from, transgressing the sidewalks.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure there will be people out there that the detractors will say, well, but that's saving the environment. Let's say, should it matter? Should you get an exemption to pedal on the street if you're saving, quote, saving, making clean air and encouraging health of people? Should it matter?
Well, if they made that claim. I think it matters because, first of all, in my particular instance, they're violating the First Amendment of free speech.
Mm-hmm.
For other organizations and individuals that want to pedal on the sidewalks and, streets and sidewalks of Honolulu.
Mm-hmm. You make an interesting point there because it is a commercial activity. I think they say nonprofit. Somewhere I read in part of their write-up or something, it was a nonprofit function. So,
well, what also is interesting is that this nonprofit is working with the for-profit corporation that is, managing or operating their business in maintaining the bikes and bike stations and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
So that also might be illegal because if you're a nonprofit, according to the one part of the ordinance, you have to be the sole entity that does it.
Understand. They don't want someone through hook and crook going through and setting up a nonprofit and then inviting a for-profit business to.
Right.
Circumventing the law or what have you.
Yeah. I haven't looked into who's involved with the for-profit portion of BikeShare or Bikey, but I remember seeing it in the paper, and I was alarmed to hear that it's supposed to be solely the nonprofit that is operating the whole, operation.
Well, I have your number, and let's see if we can get together and ask some questions because it makes the fact that they've been very coyish about getting documents, the city, and even the kid that works for the state, it's just you got to get things by hook and crook, it seems. They're not open about anything. You file a request and then they want to attach a substantial fee, so... Okay, anything else?
That's all for now. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. Aloha.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Caller, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
All right. It was very interesting. It seems that you're, if I'm not mistaken, you guys are talking about the bike share, is that the BT franchises?
Right.
Yeah. Notice that those started... sprouting up everywhere.
Yeah.
Was it earlier this year? I guess earlier this year. And what? There are really two issues, I think, that have come up in the last conversation that you had that I wanted to address. I think one is obviously this bike share thing, which is really a for-profit, bike stand. I mean, that's the reality. You have to swipe a credit card to be able to ride this bike. And I think it's like $2 or $3.50 per bike or something like that. And so it's a for-profit, really. I don't care if there's a non-profit involved. It's really a for-profit enterprise. The second aspect is transparency in regards to records and documents. And this is long, and so let me get the second one out and discuss this first. The problem, one of the problems I think with Hawaii in regards to the relationship between the state and its citizens, or the city and county and its citizens, or even in counties on the neighbor island and citizens, is the issue of transparency. That is, what are governments here, whether county governments or what is state government doing that the regular individual, the average taxpayer, should be aware of? I'll give you an example. The so-called controversy over the negotiations between the governor and Airbnb. I would note that any time that you decide to have a secret deal or you decide to have a secret negotiation, there's always going to be something that is going to be kept secret. You can't have a secret deal with everything open and on the table. There's going to be stuff that's kept secret or details that are kept confidential. And that's the problem with secret deals. And thus, when we look at the access to materials, to documents and to papers and so forth, that's critical because it allows one to look at what some of these deals, what some of these transactions are between city and state government and perhaps private entities and the private sector. And the fact that Hawaii, not only in terms of the state level but at the city-county level, has flawed transparency in regards to documents. This is an issue, for example, that Civil Beat has kind of brought up. I know you're not the biggest fan of Civil Beat, but they brought
why do you have to constantly suggest that I what my views of Civil Beat? It would be irrelevant if I thought they were just a box of rocks. It wouldn't matter. Go ahead with your topic.
Right. But what I think they have brought up, I think quite cogently, is the lack of access to, at times, to documents. And just as you mentioned, you know, attaching fees if you want certain documents and other kinds of, perhaps, you know, they may not see it as obstructions, but absolute obstructions for the average person.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's an issue that needs to be discussed even more so in the state.
Mm-hmm.
The city and county and state government should be allowed to make all kinds of deals without public disclosure at some level.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I see it. Granted, I'm biased. I used to be a journalist.
Well, the situation is that there's two problems with the secret meetings and the secret deals. One, it's our governor who's elected by the public. And two, he's overseeing the public's interest. So when he participate or lend himself or his agents to participate and condone the involvement of a project behind closed doors in secrecy without ever broaching the subject or openly telling the people specifically about this project, we only learn that, oh, they're having a meeting and it's private and it's good. And so there is where the problem is, and that's when you decide who you vote for. But then then that might trigger the question in mind is that, well, Hanabusa had some private activities too, for example, at HART. And she also had some behind-the-closed-door scenes with the city council when she represented them for the allegations of taking kickbacks or bribes or whatever it was that the complaint was filed. So it just seems to be a common practice. The theme here is that don't inform the people. Just get to know the people that the people voted in, and then you got the job completed. All your work is done. All you need to do is...
I mean, to me, it's always been a kind of, really kind of average aspect of Hawaii politics. Is a secretive aspect. Even when I was working as a journalist here, and I did cover politics at times, cover elections and interview politics,
mm-hmm.
The secretive nature of Hawaii politics is not unusual. It's really business as usual, and it's problematic, I think. I mean, I know that this Airbnb and sort of secret deal or negotiation with the governor has gotten some press, but the people who are kind of outraged about it, and they have a right to be outraged, to me, it's business as usual.
not unusual. It's, as you brought up with Hanabusa, it's stuff that's going on all the time. Go ahead.
It's a common practice. I mean, without it, I don't think it's I what is it? It is what it is. I guess it's
right.
It's you emerging from plantation days, and some people get in power, and then they hope to stay in power, and then but I think the answer to it all is to go back to democratic open process.
Right.
And you go to Olelo, for example. Olelo was once headed by Mike Amia, Roy Amia, Amamia, right? And he's city council. He works for the mayors now. He's appointed, right? And that, just that thing in itself, which is supposed to be a resource for the public community to be able to have a voice, because it's a compensation for use of easements and what have you in the, you know, the cable companies, right? But you go over there now, they have their secret meetings. The governor just had some kind of program about last October or this last month, or where myself personally was one of my shows where I couldn't film because the crew was dedicated to this, quote, last-minute project.
Yeah, now, I know. You told me about that.
Now,
I can't say that I'm surprised.
Now, you know, just that along, and yet they tout themselves as being freedom of speech and what have you, and they should be by just the nature of things, the natural order. But even that, they've gotten their control, you see, and I think that the public is being deprived, and they got rigid hours now and structured. The hours do not complement the need for the community.
Right.
It has executive type hours, you know, Sundays
right.
You close. People available on weekends when they're free,
institutional.
Right?
Institutional.
Yeah.
They become an institution, and when you become an institution, you work according to institutional rules.
Right.
And structures and procedures.
And
so that limits access. I mean, from that perspective,
mm-hmm.
It can limit access if you're not willing to abide by their rules and their structure.
Well, and by their rules, for, give you an example, and this is relevant for me. I was going to interview a young man that works there, volunteers at Olelo. I schedule a film date. I go in to film. I'm met by the president or the CEO who's now serving there, and he's, "What are you doing? Oh, I'm here to film." Oh. That's going to be a lot of noise in there, you know. Then, in reality, they tell me, "Well, you know, your show was canceled." "What do you mean my show was canceled?" "Well, yeah, we don't know. Well, we know someone canceled it, but you're the only one that can cancel it. Did you cancel?" "No, I didn't cancel it. If I canceled, I wouldn't be here to come in the film." So, basically, they canceled the studio shoot for me, and in turn, their explanation was the governor had this last minute desire to participate in a forum with the education program, and I have it written down. But again, you see to what length they will go to, and yet these are people that supposedly enhancing the public's right to public access and communications, right, free speech and what have you. Yet
right.
They are part of the. And so then I get a call telling me, "Well, you know, your show is going to be canceled because you've missed three times." Well, the first time I missed it was that their dates were wrong. You see, so the institution now, everything is crept into that agency or that organization.
Right.
It's a nonprofit running it, right? But now it's become an institution. It has become a corporation. You follow. Once again,
that's what I mean.
Depriving
that's
what the public.
I say it becomes institutional when you turn it into an institution as opposed to simply an organization.
Yeah.
It becomes something different. It probably was an organization before. Now it's an institution.
The
rules are different.
Adhering to the purpose of it and trying to enhance that, not to get work away from the real importance of it and its purpose, initially public access television.
Right.
Right.
Right. But it's access to some of the public, not all the public.
Well, no, they tend to now to court nonprofits and people with specific agendas. But see, my problem is when you start tinkering with me and my rights, then I'm as nice and I'm the most jolliest of people. But, you know, I value my rights, and I will, you know, go to eat birthday cake with them again. But don't tread on my rights. Don't deprive the public as a total. And then when you're implementing these strategies, becoming political and abusing your authority, abusing the right and your responsibility to the public, see, they may have a different idea. Well, we'll shut him off. Well, there is no shutting off. You know.
Well, and any time you deal with broadcasting, it's a matter of control. There's no such thing as absolute free access to views. You see this happening on YouTube, where you have politically oriented shows and politically oriented videos. They're beginning to get a pushback from YouTube because they're demonetizing it. So these people have to get Patreon. They have to find other ways to support themselves.
Let's be very specifically and clear. You see, you're mixing apples. YouTube is a commercial entity.
Right. But right.
Wait. Not, hold on. Hold on.
Let me
make my point.
Right.
Let's start off with the structural part of it. One, that's commercial. That's driven by a person taking his chances and investing his money and resources. Olelo is not that. Olelo is a product that is as a result of the public's resources being taken from them or being used by an entity, the compensation to the public for the use of that resource. And that then someone oversees that and managing it, the interests of the people and the use of that. That's the big difference, see. So, yes, it is broadcast, but it's a different a horse of a different color. Completely,
right.
You see. Completely.
I'm not saying the two are absolutely the same in terms of their status. The one is nonprofit, the other is profit.
Right.
What I'm talking about is the overall aspect of view.
Yeah.
Not the financial structure.
But see, we can't...
So the control of views is going to happen whether it is non-profit or for-profit.
No, you're that's
going
a,
to have
that's a
media.
That's a hybridization of... It's hybridized into something that nobody's ever even characterized or put a label on it because it's, first of all, you're there because the public resources were taken or loaned to this individual, and as a compensation for the use of public resources, that they didn't have to dig their own holes and put their own lines up and go through that. They used the existing resources in the easements. And so as a result of that, the public then is allotted certain dollar amounts or whatever, and then as a result of that, Olelo is born. And as a result of that, we pick someone to manage that, the interests of the public. Not to incorporate and hybridize, become a hybridized entity that is part business and this, and with the ultimate goal is enhancing themselves. No, enhancing public access, public opportunity, and
right.
That's the bigger difference, the big difference there, as
right.
far as YouTube.
Well, you're approaching what that used to be, and as opposed to what it is now. What it was as opposed to what it
is. Well, what it's supposed
what it's
to be.
Something else.
What it's supposed. You start from the basics. This is what you get your birth, and these conditions. This is what brought you. This is what created Olelo. Then you can't deviate from that. You can't. That's not a murky picture. It's very specific, with
right.
specific conditions. The PUC, the DCCA, and all of those people. There is the legislators and all of that. I sat down and said, okay, we will accept this, but this is what you'll have to do to compensate. And in doing so,
right.
So anyway, the point is, this is consistent with many of things here in the state, that people commandeer the wheelhouse and start to steer the ship in their direction to what destination they choose to be, and excluding the public. That's the danger of this. And so whether it's agriculture...
If to do that, they need to exclude the public, because if the public gets involved, they could put pressure which will get in the way of their making profit, if they want to extract profit. They don't want the profit, the flow of profit or the potential profit to be cut off, delayed. They want to be able to get that profit and to get the flow of that profit moving in their direction. So you can't have public access, because that means public pressure. And public pressure might turn into legislative action or council action or some kind of legal action that could get in the way.
But,
and they don't want that.
But you do agree, though, that this is public resources. And so when all theories of plenty of them, we don't care about that.
In the case of this bike share thing, what's outrageous is that they're setting these stands up on these public sidewalks, and they're public. They're not private. They're public sidewalks. And these are for, whether they say it or not, it's for profit. To use these bikes, you can't use them for free. You have to have a credit card, and you have to pay about $2-3 around there to use these bikes for about 30 minutes or so. And people do that, and that's their choice. But this isn't for, this isn't a non-profit enterprise. It's a profit enterprise.
So
you have to ask, why are they being allowed to do this when other people, like if you were to stand on a sidewalk and sell, DVDs or CDs, they tell you can't do that because you don't have a permit.
You know why I don't do that? Because I might get choked out by the police, and I might be shot.
There you go. That's what I mean. You can't do that because you don't have...
It's not good to be selling CDs on the street corner in today's world.
like you used to have in Waikiki, you have to have vendors in Waikiki selling stuff.
That's straying way from the pasture that I wanted to graze in today. I'm saying to you and the listeners out there, our problem is we know what we have as a public interest in public resources. We know it's defined. It's that element that creeps into and weds itself up and get people inside, get our legislators to lend an ear, and then you find yourself as we talked 2 weeks ago with Ulupono. Now, Ulupono was in the initiative, has something to do with the dairy on the Big Island, not the Big Island, but Kauai. And in the meantime, the court's ruling against them, and they're now attorney fees and all that, $506,000 to be awarded to the other side, the plaintiffs, who challenged them on the dairy. And yet, the agriculture, in this article, the agriculture department rejected, had a grant, right? And the state agriculture people pulled out on that. Now, how did they get involved in that? And then we see that the director, Scott Enright, comes to meetings and publicly say how well he's in tight with the Ulupono people and how well he works for them, right?
I guess.
Yeah. So it's that kind of practices and that kind of relationship that lending itself to that. And by the way, when you keep, I don't know why it's important to represent what I think or don't think about Civil Beat. But Civil Beat has its birthplace, too, in funding from Ulupono or Omidyar?
Well,
no,
I don't
know. No. I mean, you speak when one say to me, well, you know, I know you have this about Civil Beat, which is not accurate, but being that you say that, if you know that detail about something that's not factual, let's speak to the real facts. What does Ulupono have to do with Civil Beat?
I don't know. I didn't.
It has some relationship, right? Some funding?
I don't know. I'm not an expert when it comes to Ulupono and Civil Beat.
Oh, okay. But that wouldn't. You could. a guy just casually sitting at the park would know that if you've been awake at the wheel. But anyway, that is something that is of grave concern, because Bike Share Hawaii, Ulupono, and not to impugn their integrity or say that this is bad, it's just that we got Bicky Share.
Well, see, that's the point, though. The point that I was making, again, is the allowance of a profit-making enterprise on these public... You talk about public resources and extracting profit from it. That's what's happening. These are on public sidewalks, and someone is making... The Beekeeper organization behind it, they're making money off of this. But if an individual were to try to make money just trying to do something, they couldn't do it. So it's a matter of organizations or institutions or for-profit enterprises. They can go and set up shop on a public sidewalk and they can make money.
Right.
The average individual can't.
So here's support of this article, today's article, and sorry, advertiser Maureen O'Connelly. Supporters of the call for more local production and greater food service security, such as Honolulu's Ulupono Initiative, an investment firm specializing in environmental sustainability, maintained that while the governor's 2020 goal is now likely unrealistic, given still steep hurdles, the push forward should continue. So this is while the governor is they're courting this, and his director of the agriculture department is in tight with them, with Ulupono. They're failing over there and getting fined or getting decisions rendered against them to pay $506,000 because of concerns for their approach to the not adhering to the environmental laws or the and what have you. You follow no NPDES permits and conducting construction work on the dairy. So it's when our government partners up with people of this behavior, then what do we do? How can we win? Right? So that's the... And again, Ulupono got great ideas, but again, there just seems to be a couple of them that I'm aware of. I have to scratch my head and ask the question,
right.
Gee.
But the take-home point is this. The protection has to be... There has to be a way to prevent public resources from falling into private hands. Because if public resources fall into private hands for private profit, then the public is short-changed.
Yeah,
they don't have the resources that those institutions have. They can't set up and make money without ruining public resources themselves.
Right.
But those institutions can't. That to me is unfair. Like I said, what the point that I mentioned about bike share versus just somebody hawking something on a sidewalk. You can't do that nowadays.
Right.
You can't even do that on Waikiki.
The article goes on. The agriculture department spent $90,000 on the computer program, with Ulupono contributing a $160,000 grant. But after long delays and subsequently contracted work that failed to meet the state's needs, the Agriculture Department pulled the plug.
In other words, somebody got paid.
Well, I won't say that. It's just that it's either... I believe Ulupono has great ideas, but I believe also the people that working for the state have bad ideas and lend themselves, because they're politically connected, and lend themselves, they can operate. Scott Enright was operating loosely as if it was his business, and then the Agriculture Development Corporation and all. So it's called too big for your britches, and especially when your pockets are filled with public money. That's
right.
The problem.
Or as also known, all hat and no cattle.
Yeah, well, this is the problem, and again... Ulupono and then it's doing only what others are allowed to do. I mean, if the government receives them and invites them into these programs, I won't be critical of Ulupono for doing that. I mean, they're only doing what is legal. It's just that the people that are in government and working with them needs to be on their best game, you know. And that's about it. But anyway, we're down to the last second, so thanks for joining in. We'll talk next week, all right? And this is the Carol Cox Show. Thanks for joining. We'll see you next week. Aloha.
This has been the Carol Cox Show, heard every Sundays at 9 a.m. on K108. Tune in again next week, Sunday at 9 a.m. to the Carol Cox Show on 1080 a.m. KWAI Honolulu.